Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast. I'm Neil Lawson, your host and director of Compass. These are unprecedented times, and we need to rise to the new and enormous challenges we now face. Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and public service workers about how we come out of this mess in much better shape than we went in, a good society after COVID-19. These conversations have live access for Compass members who can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to participate in the live call and help support all of our work, go to compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's podcast. This week on the Compass podcast, we've delved back 5 years to that incredible referendum. How time flies when you're enjoying yourself. To do it, we welcome three absolute Compass stalwarts. John Trickett, the Labour MP for Hemsworth, who's a senior advisor to Jeremy Corbyn, a long-term member of the Shadow Cabinet. And before that, he was the parliamentary representative of Compass, let us not forget. Anthony Barnett was one of the co-founders of Open Democracy and author of the brilliant book, The Lure of Greatness, which everyone should dig out. And then finally, Zoe Williams, who's the Guardian journalist and was a leading light in Another Europe Is Possible. Welcome, all of you, and thanks for being with us tonight. Before I turn to you, just a bit of background on Compass and Europe, or Europe and Compass. We've always been strong internationalists. We spent almost a decade working on the Good Europe project, trying to develop a continent-wide basis for a more equal, democratic and sustainable Europe. We ran events across the whole of Europe. But it's safe to say there was pretty much zero interest from the British Labour Party, with a few honourable exceptions. We continue to make the case for Europe right up to the referendum, but with much bigger fish making the case for Remain, we made this case for a good Europe, whether you wanted in or out. With the referendum over, and again with much bigger fish making the case for a people's vote, we focused on the causes and cures for Brexit, and John Trickett helped us with that publication. And so you can look back to that and the work that we did looking at the deeper reasons for Brexit, because our first thought as Compass wasn't to have another go at the question, but to ask the big thing about what had happened and why. In the wake of the Brexit vote and the idea of a progressive alliance began to match the defeat of the regressive alliance, that notion of the progressive alliance was fully born. In the parliamentary deadlock to find a deal, we ran the campaign for a citizens' assembly to decide on what to do if Parliament couldn't or wouldn't. Through that campaign, we helped to put assemblies on the political map. In the end, of course, it was all settled through the crushing defeat of the 2009 general election. So what did we all get wrong? What, if anything, went right? And where do we go from here? The format for the podcast, as ever, will be I'll ask our guests some questions and then it'll be over to our members. Over to our guests, and I'm going to ask you in turn, starting with you, Zoe, you know, what's been the big lesson? 5 years, is it really 5 years on, Zoe? You know, what's been the big lesson for you that you've been thinking about, you know, since that interesting night 5 years ago?
Is that my question, whether it's really 5 years? Because I can answer that really easily.
Well, in relative or kind of, you know, objective terms, you know.
I mean, I've spent so long ruminating that I find it quite difficult to distinguish between what is self-flagellation, what is despair, and what is actual learning. So it's possible that what I say now will kind of sound intermittently, will toggle between those two things. And obviously, they're not that useful, you know. Kind of maudlin despair about the state of the nation is not that useful in terms of kind of personal growth. That's just the backdrop. I remember when we were deciding what to do in the bloody referendum, and this wasn't just Compass, and it wasn't just Neon. It was like every left space I was in spent quite a long time deciding what side we were on. And the arguments were really good, right? They were interesting. They were very knowledgeable often. They were very nuanced. There was kind of, you know, the EU isn't perfect. Look at these imperfect things it's done. The kind of whole focus on technocracy and democratic deficit and whether or not a kind of accelerating power over people without any accelerating democratic voice could possibly be a good thing to campaign for, and who even were we? And it kind of came down in the end to, did we want to be on the same side as David Cameron, which nobody did, or did we want to sort of be, you know, rogues, kind of pro-Brexit rogues? And in the end, what we reached, as far as I was concerned, was quite a rational conclusion. I don't want to be on the same side as David Cameron, nor do I want to leave the European Union, nor do I want an end to international cooperation, nor do I fully endorse everything the EU has ever done with this campaign. And I feel like that kind of combination of rationalism, nuance, complexity, ambivalence sort of defined who we were then and defines who we are now and defines everything that's gone wrong for the progressive side for the past 5 years, because it's very, very difficult to have rational, nuanced, complex conversations in a political discourse of the abstract and the binary. You know, we're dealing with huge abstract things like sovereignty, and it's very, very difficult to meet their emotional register, let alone beat their emotional register. And I suppose that's the first thing I've learned, is when somebody's coming at you with huge abstract things, you know, sovereignty, take control of your money and your future, and somebody's coming up at you with these ideas which are kind of too large to be able to iterate them in real life, your answer, well, what do you actually mean, take control of my money, but hang on a second, my passport could have been blue all along, all these kind of quite rational answers have no means of meeting that kind of language. And it didn't meet it at the time, and it hasn't met it at any point since. There were kind of other mistakes, you know, there's kind of a very sincere and obviously unarguable case by David Runciman that anybody who thought they could carry on arguing the referendum after the referendum was done had simply and straightforwardly misunderstood the parliamentary system. And I see the wisdom in that now. But actually, I think there's something more fundamental, because we're going to carry on having this argument, literally, even having left the EU, we're going to carry on having this argument about that, done down exactly the same tram lines with exactly the same large abstracts meeting exactly the same concrete arguments again and again and again, because those large abstract arguments work very well for people who don't have a plan and don't have any kind of concrete or sincere vision of what they want the country to look like. And they work very badly for people who do have a concrete and sincere vision, but don't quite know how to get there. So I suppose that's the kind of fundamental learning, is that Brexit may be over, but it's never going to be over until there's a better way of meeting the kind of almost gross emotional language that Brexit was ushered in on. And I think allied to that, the reason everybody came down pro-EU in the end, even though a lot of people were very ambivalent about it, was that it was plain at the time and since that the driving force behind the Brexit agenda was a far-right project. So whatever you say about the class mix of people who voted for it, about whether it was the left behind or whether it was pensioners, the same people who drove the project are the same people who drove Boris Johnson into government. And it was a combination of hedge fund managers and property developers. And it is a new kind of far-right agenda pushed by people for whom political volatility allied by democratic impotence is the best possible combination for their concentration of wealth. It's been really obvious ever since. And I feel like it's a kind of catastrophic situation on the left that we really spent quite a large part of the intervening 5 years arguing amongst ourselves about who adequately responded to the conditions on the left and the conditions of the people who the left should be fighting for. I'm not saying, hang on a second, there's Dominic Cummings driving £8 billion worth of fire truck towards everything we hold dear over there. And we never kind of dropped the nuance for long enough to say this is the far right on the march, and they still are on the march.
Okay, so Brexit has many sons and daughters. It's going to keep coming at us. And as ever with Compass, we've got that kind of complicated, nuanced, reflective politics versus kind of brute simplicity. We'll come back to that towards the end, particularly about how we deepen democracy. So, Anthony, over to you. You know, what have you learned, and what's your big take over the last 5 years?
Well, listening to Zoe, I think I deeply and profoundly agree with her. and I'm trying to work out in what way I don't. And I think the area where I don't agree is that I think that we can meet their emotional register. We should have met their emotional register. And some of us, if I may blow my own trumpet, because I wrote this book online called Blimey, It Could Be Brexit during the referendum, did get the fact that the Remain side didn't. So the first thing I think in terms of the complexity about should you be for or against being part of the European Union is that, and it's a phrase that goes right back to a book Tom Nairn wrote in the 1970s, it's the terrain of reality. If you want to meet the capitalist enemy, you have to do it inside the European Union. It's not whether it is capitalist or it isn't. It's the idea that the British state is somehow or other going to be a more progressive terrain than the European zone is absurd. It's just completely preposterous. And so, you know, life begins inside the European Union. That's the reality that is going to be imposed. It is part of what we are. It's where we are in the world. And that's why Zoe is completely right to say Brexit is not going to go away. And she's also completely right to say that the project, the Brexit, the great British Brexit project, is inherently, intrinsically a right-wing project. And that means that we're trapped within it. There isn't a left-wing version of Brexit that we can adapt. And it was a catastrophic error of the Labour Party to say, oh, well, that's it, folks. Oh, we can move on. Because when Johnson said, let's get Brexit done, what that meant was, let's get to the negotiated deal. But Brexit is just beginning. You know, they're now sitting down with terrorists, with the Ulster Volunteers in Northern Ireland, to work out how they can collaborate in terms of trying to keep the union together, because they're so frightened of Scotland. They're going to come to that. So Brexit is just beginning. The battle, the fight over Brexit is just beginning, and is going to be with us for the next generation. So the question, I think, that which I can add to what Zoe said, and where I suppose there's this element of disagreement, is that I think the great error of the Remain campaign was to back off the issue which the Brexiteers understood and exploited, which is the catastrophic loss of a sense of agency in British society. This isn't just because of the British ruling elite being such a shambles and being corrupt and the House of Lords and so on, but the sense that the constitution was broken, the sense that we don't know who we are as a country, it was that sense. And instead of saying, well, you have a slogan, stronger in. Well, stronger in says, A, we're weak. B, there's nothing we can do about it. C, let's keep our fingers crossed and hope everything comes to the better. I mean, it's like saying there's nothing we can do about agency. And if somebody comes along and says, well, we've got a problem, here is a solution. If nobody else is willing to address the problem, which the Remain campaign weren't, then they're going to walk all over us, which is what they've done. So what is, to be very crude and brief, the gutsy, the emotional register we've got to meet? It's very simple. We've got to speak for England. England is the missing country. It was England that voted for Brexit. It was England outside of London that voted by an 11% majority for Brexit. Of course, there was a lot of Russian stuff. There was a lot of black money. There was a lot of manipulation. And it certainly, almost certainly, tipped the vote, which was a 2% vote, in favor of Brexit. But the core, the absolute burning core of Brexit, and the reason why opinion hasn't shifted since, is that there was a real decision taken by the English outside of London, which is, get off our backs, we want to be our own boss, etc. And unless you're willing to meet the national question, unless you're willing to meet the question of agency, we're going to act forever inside Boris Johnson, whoever succeeds Boris Johnson, inside the Brexit narrative. There isn't an alternative to it. So the way out, the very simple way out, and what I think every progressive, whether you're in the centre or a Liberal Democrat or a Green or a light red or right winger or a Labour middleist or a Labour left-wing or a compass, every progressive should be saying to Scotland, yes, please go independent. Yes, we want to support your independence in Europe. yes, that's the only, we've got to break this concept of Great Britishness. And that's why they're worried about Northern Ireland, which otherwise they wouldn't give a toss about in terms of Downing Street. And that's why they've got a whole unit developed to how do they save the Union? Because the Union is critical to their, so to speak, not, it's not an imperial narrative, but it's a sort of our answer to agency, our hedge fund answer, as they rightly said, which will, you know, is to say that we are a great world power with lots of arrows going to and all that. And we've got to break that narrative. And the only way of breaking that narrative that's left to us is to say we need to end the Union. So England needs to be liberated from Westminster.
Okay, so that's a big son and daughter of Brexit and a bigger shock to the British state than Brexit even, the breakup of the Union. So we'll try and come back to that as well. But let's hear from John and his perspective of, you know, what's your big take, John, and what have you learned over and thought about mostly over the last 5 years after that historic vote?
My personal regret is I didn't fight my corner strong enough, I think. You know, I was inside the inner team, four or five politicians around Jeremy. We were loyal to the project, even though, you know, we all had different points of view. I felt we made some quite big mistakes in relation to the matter we're discussing. I fought my corner, I think everybody knows that, probably, inside that group. But the loyalty to the project, though I did try to resign on one or two occasions from the front bench to make the case, it meant that I was silent when I should have been more visible. But look, I think to explain where I was at the time, maybe, and then to project forward to now, because what I was saying then, I look back and think it was about right, was I warned Jeremy, actually in writing, though I didn't intend for it to leak, but it did leak into The Guardian when one of the staff left and leaked a lot of emails. And I warned him that the position which Labour took before the referendum, which was remain and reform, was in danger of being lost. And I predicted we would lose the referendum, those who wanted to remain, on the because we hadn't done enough to explain why we thought that the European Union needed to be reformed. Because it was patently obvious that a huge part of the country, including in the end 68%, of everybody who voted in my constituency, who voted to leave, it was patently obvious that people had run out of patience with the existing, I suppose, post-Thatcher settlement. And I think, you know, the idea that ruling blocks, the ruling class, can only rule with consent is true, but the consent of so many people in the country had been withdrawn. People no longer believed, particularly the political class, that it was capable of governing the country in a way which was consistent with their hopes and needs. And so I did say to Jeremy, you know, this issue of what is our central critique, if we're going to remain and argue for remain, of how the European Union is now functioning, and secondly and equally importantly, how on earth, given the structures of the European Union, are you going to reform it? Since it's a massively bureaucratic and undemocratic institution, as we would all, I guess we all agree with that. Now, I was very anxious in the weeks and, in fact, the whole of the time running up to the referendum, and we simply didn't get our message out there. People have said that Jeremy didn't try. That is absolutely untrue. He travelled thousands of miles, as he's wont to do on the trains, giving you his timetable from one place to the next, as he wants to do. And, you know, he went out. But I think we didn't get our voice heard on this reform argument, because it seems to me that to argue for the status quo, when so many people in the country have lost any sense of confidence in the way our country is being governed, is not where the left needs to be. If you think about it for 1 second, that is not where the left is or wants to be. So our reform argument simply wasn't made. Now, when the Brexit vote came, clearly I was in a position where more than two-thirds of people in my constituency had voted to leave, and the Leave voters won in the country. And it seemed to me that we now had to make the best of a very difficult situation since we'd argued for Remain. And I made two central arguments at that time. The first was that, you know, we needed to build a movement for a democratic revolution, a revolution through the British state. And I wrote the piece in the 2017 manifesto. It doesn't use the word democratic revolution, but it does talk about a massive constitutional convention led by citizens' assemblies to try to describe how the country, people want the country to be governed. That would inevitably have taken into account where we were in relation to the European Union. It would have broadened the issue and led, in my view, to a completely restructured British state, a disaggregated state, devolution, federalism. I don't think it's for English politicians to say what the Scots should do, so I shall not go down that track, though Anthony would like us to. So that was the first pillar. If you look at the 2017 and 2019 manifestos, you'll see my words written there, calling for really a political revolution. However, when it came to the Constitutional Convention, somebody, I'm not going to say who, but I know their identity, changed the manifesto so that in the first manifesto, it talked about transforming our political structures at every level. By the time we got to the 2019 manifesto, it then became, we would consider how Parliament operates. That is not what I thought, and it's not what I wrote, but that's what got into the manifesto. Nonetheless, disaggregating the state, restoring the power of agency, a sense of control over our lives, that has to be at the core of any new Britain which emerges out of the ashes of the 2019 election, if the left is going to make any progress. But the second point, which I'm going to explain, not in as much detail, but it needs to be understood, was the argument I was making inside the, we might call it the kitchen cabinet, was, Jeremy, there is only one person in the country who could make a case for progressive internationalism, and that's you. What we should do is, for example, you take the trade and aid policies of the European Union. They are exploitative. If you look at how Nigeria is being treated and many other places which receive European aid, they're made to privatise water and all the other things. So it's a liberal, neoliberal kind of imposition. And all over the world, there are progressives in government and out, in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia and elsewhere, who would welcome a debate about Britain constructing a new set of world trading relationships on a non-exploitative basis and on the basis of social justice and, you know, peace. So no one in Britain could make a better speech than Jeremy. And he was, and I argued the point time and time and time again. Every time he agreed to do it, and every time it didn't happen, I've only just recently discovered why it didn't happen. And it was because the Labour Party committed itself to staying within the customs union. Now think about that. So although we were arguing about what kind of Brexit Labour might endorse, if any, we did commit ourselves from the start to staying in the customs union, and therefore the kind of big speech which could have been made wasn't made. Now, I'm going to finish on this sort of thought, if I can, for the moment, which is this. Do not tell me that the people who voted for Remain would not respond to a new vision of Britain's role in the world based on internationalism, opposing racism and xenophobia. Bearing in mind, the European Union is really 500 million white people with a Christian heritage. Bear that in mind. I think I'm right in saying only one or two MEPs ever have been anything other than ethnic white. I think I'm right in saying that. So there are major criticisms we could make of it. Now, that speech never got made, and the democratic stuff was, I was left in the corner in my office writing the stuff, which was then spiked for one reason or another. I do believe there was a way forward for the left. And my lesson, if you want me to say what my personal lesson is, I should have made my case stronger. I should have probably got out if it was necessary to make the case. But there were other factors at stake. And the big factor was, could we, for the first time in our lifetimes, elect a progressive government capable of bringing about all kinds of social, political and economic reforms? And I think that was an overriding imperative in all our minds. So it's kind of where I think we now are. The arguments I used then, before the referendum, after the referendum, up to 2019, still seem to me to be broadly where the Labour Party, but let's put that to one side, where the left needs to be.
Okay, good stuff. I mean, a very, very big, broad canvas there from the three of you, and I'd expect nothing less. So back to you, Zoe. I mean, come back and reflect on anything that you've heard from Anthony or John. But also, you know, what do you think the task is now? Because there seems to be a kind of, you know, either there are some people, outriders, which I think we can dismiss as, you know, the rejoin now brigade, who still haven't listened, or they completely ignore it and stick your head in the sand and hope Europe goes away. And as Anthony said, it's not going to go away because it's going to keep reverberating around. And we need a position both about Europe and internationalism. So what's the essence of the kind of narrative argument positioning that we need to be adopting now?
I'm just reflecting for a second on what John just said, because it strikes me that one of the problems we had, both responding to the Brexit case as it was made and responding to the cases that have been made since, is that we, on the left generally, and actually on the left quite broadly, hold ourselves to quite high standards of consistency. So we hold ourselves to standards of consistency across our own thinking, and we hold ourselves to standards of consistency between each other. So we require our views to be consistent and coherent, and that makes it quite hard to formulate, you know, to give that speech that John's talking about, that Jeremy could have made about the EU, because it, you know, there is a lot of good that it did and a lot of bad that it did. And it's very hard to take a kind of consistent ideological approach to it and say it was this thing or it was that thing. What we've been really bedeviled by is that the right holds itself to no standards of consistency at all. And it just really struck me with Greece that when Cameron and Osborne were trying to get elected in 2010, they were talking about Greece as this basket case, who were in a financial crisis because they were lazy, who didn't know how to work. And then when they were trying to make the case against their kind of conservative peers were, well, compatriots were trying to make the case against Europe, they were saying, look what Europe did to Greece. Now it would have been no different to what they would have done to Greece given half the chance. They have absolutely no consistency across their own ideological frame. And I say that not as a criticism of the right, but because it serves them extremely well. If you have no internal or intra-consistency in your viewpoint or your arguments, then you can literally leap from customs union one moment to complete Singapore in the sea the next. You can leap to a border down the Irish Sea to a border between the two islands the next. You can leap from any position. It makes them extremely agile. And I do think going forward, that's what we have to kind of think about, is just how incredibly agile people are when they have no consistency and no real moral compass. They are extraordinary in the way they move. And I won't talk about Scotland at the moment because I'm still slightly reeling from Anthony's idea. I do have, call it a sentimental attachment, or call it an absolute dread of being left in this rump, in this tedious fascist rump of England. I just can't fucking stand it. But anyway, so let's leave Scotland. Let's leave Scotland for 5 minutes. I mean, going forward, I think the problem both with the referendum and with the 2010 election and with the 2015 election and weirdly with the 2019 election, though not with the 2017 election, is that Labour is embarrassed of its own values. You know, it was, Miliband was embarrassed of being, of kind of having any sense of human rights on immigration. Sorry, this was 2015. Miliband was extremely embarrassed of his own values. Jeremy in 2017 was not embarrassed, but in 2019 he was embarrassed. And I don't think for the reasons that John describes. I think he was embarrassed because he was trying to ride two horses. And if there's one thing Jeremy did really well, it's ride one horse. Riding two horses, he just looked like a bad, incompetent version of everybody else. And in 2017, the one time the party made a really full-throated expression of who it was remarkable, and remarkable how easily it overcame the media narratives that previously and afterwards it blamed for all its woes. It is actually capable, when it takes the gloves off, of making a case for itself. But it's going through exactly the same thing at the moment. It's embarrassed of being anti-racist. It's embarrassed of being pro-human rights. It's embarrassed of being pro-immigration. It's embarrassed of having ever been pro-EU. It's embarrassed of everything that makes it the party that it is. And that, I think, is the first thing to overcome. And part of that, I'm thinking specifically about the conversation about the white working class, which was unleashed by this Commission on Education report, we're still stuck in this trammel that we've been stuck in for at least 5, if not 7 or 8 years, where there is no longer a working class. There's no longer a class which has kind of militant or leftist or organized or empowered tendencies. There's only a white working class. And the word white is doing a lot of heavy lifting there. The word white is saying these people are traditional, they're sentimental, they're socially sadistic. They have these views which have nothing to do with their political agency as a class and everything to do with their resentment of other groups. And unless you can listen respectfully to that, then you're not going to win those people and you're not going to win any elections. And the Labour Party, as far as I'm concerned, has been just basically rolling over to that narrative and saying, and embarrassed to make the case for who it is ever since that mirage was invented. And until we find a way to say that is a mirage, that's not actually who people are, we're going to lose and keep on losing, I think.
So that was great. I'm not saying I agree with it all, but I think it was great because it cracks open again and takes us back to that kind of simplicity versus complexity stuff. And Anthony, over to you right. to say what you think we need to be doing next. But when you said that, when you talked in your initial piece about the loss of agency, I first thought you meant class, but you didn't say class. You went on to talk about kind of political citizenship agency, not class agency.
Yeah.
And the issue of class plays through this and right across this in a way that, again, I mean, Zoe's begun to crack it open, but unless we can deal with that, you know, that historic progressive dilemma issue of uniting class interests, then we are not building on any kind of foundations. I think, back to that, but also what else we need to be doing. Thank you.
The route to democracy lies more through the nation than through class. But I feel two things about what Zoe and John have said. What Zoe's just said, I've fallen a bit in love with Zoe as a result of what she just said. Both because most of what she said about the Labour Party not being true to itself, riding horses, etc., I can put it much better than I could have done. So that's just wow. And also when she said about Scotland, what she said, although I think it's profoundly wrong, is absolutely truthful. I don't want to be left with this fascist rump, is how you put it. Now, just think of this. This is what's wonderful about this. This is what really is at the heart of you know, millions of progressive people. London, Yorkshire, the West Country, Birmingham, you know, Manchester. This is not a fascist rump. This is our country, right? And this is a great country. This is the country of Blake and of Paine and of Shelley, you know, and of Morris. This is a great country. And the fact that we can't even embrace it, the fact that we think, you know, we're English, right? Oh, my God, it's a fascist rump. That's the reason for Brexit. This is the core reason for Brexit, is that we betrayed our own country by that. But it was very honestly said. And I think that's where deep introspection and a transformation is needed. You know, we must speak for England. If we don't speak for England, we're lost. It's as simple as that. Now, let me just say about what John said, because oddly enough, it's completely the other way around. John is a rare politician who has said we should speak for England. He may not want to say anything about Scotland, but at least he has said as a politician, you know, we've got to talk about the English. Apart from that, everything he said is deeply and profoundly misconceived. First of all, the way he talks about Europe, the way he's basically saying Europe is a white, racist, Christian project we should have nothing to do with, is completely misconceived, right? Europe is our continent. And the idea that Europe is bureaucratic and difficult to change because it's a neoliberal project, and the British state's had 250 years of fixing things. It's a much, much more formidable enemy than the European Commission. The European Commission has had, I don't know how many in its short life, there's been Rome, there's been Maastricht, there's been Nice, there's been Lisbon. It keeps on having sitting down and changing itself. In the middle of the pandemic, Macron said, either we are solidarity or we have nothing. And then immediately got his own country, France, and various other countries to sign a letter against Germany saying we've got to have a £750 billion solidarity fund or we're lost, right? And there is a €750 billion solidarity fund. Now, when we were talking about Brexit, John would have told me this was completely impossible. It's a neoliberal fix. It's an extremely weak, young, stiff organization, which is very easily changed. All it would take is a combined progressive government in Germany, France, and the UK. Were we in it, right? Now it will take just you know, Germany may well have a green chancellor, and we'll see what happens in France. But of course, you know, Europe is going to change, and Europe is because it is about changing. Europe is about, sort of, it was a neoliberal entity, and what's happened to neoliberalism? Well, the American president has called time on neoliberalism. Using those terms, right? I mean, it's quite important that. It's not like, oh, they're stumbling into it. His chief of staff is actually, you know, his security advisor, Jake Sullivan, denounced neoliberalism by name just before he was appointed. So we've got now, you know, a very important transformation taking place in the United States. And where are we? We're absolutely nowhere. The Brexit project is completely misconceived and is intrinsically right-wing. And therefore, this is the question that I would put to what John said. He said, you know, that the consent is crucial and that the British people, and in particular his constituents, had withdrawn consent from the elite. Quite right. And if that's the case, we have to meet that head on. Quite right. And what do we say to them? We don't say to them, you've withdrawn consent, you need to take control, but it's consent of Westminster. It's not, European Union was not the cause of it. European Union was not what was going wrong with this country. The European Union was marginal, and it still is marginal. That's what's so clear about it. To say, when he says, look, we need a restructuring of the British state, yes, that's what we should have said to them. We should have said, let's take back control, but control is with Westminster. That's where the struggle was. And I say this with some passion, if I may say, because where everybody is now, you know, everything is now open. So when John said to us early in the Corbyn, when Corbyn began, he said, look, let's have a constitutional and political revolution. That's wonderful. And I went to see him. I said, this is fantastic. No Polish has never said this before. Let's start with PR. Let's make it really clear. That's a simple thing to do, and it opens the way up. No, says John. PR, we could still be governed by an elite with PR, which of course is true. So we're not going to do it. So it became, you know, we've got to do everything. And the result was, and it was really predictable, we got nothing. It got fixed by people saying, well, you can't say that, focus group, and so on. So the sense of an enormous lost opportunity, we needed to say to people, this is where I agree deeply with John, who felt we're basically run by crooks, right? We're basically run by people like Cameron and Blair and company like that, who are betraying, they don't believe in our country. They just are making money out of it. Tony Blair's flying around in Gaddafi's jet. You know, this is contemptible. They felt shame, anger, and rage and powerlessness. And instead of allowing them to take that out on the EU, we should have to take this out on the real enemy. And that's what Corbyn could have said that, and John could have said that. And then, of course, even if his own people would still voted for Brexit, they would have been proud of him. He would have had a real story to tell them. People can say, because he's saying, yeah, of course you've got to take back control, the fundamental issue of agency we should have agreed on. And the deep thing about the Remain campaign, which is an utter shambles, is that they just wanted to carry on. They didn't want to meet that issue. But we can't meet the issue by agreeing with it. I really want to emphasize the idea that we, Britain, could have created an internationalist project, only we've been caught by the fact that the Labour Party is committed to staying in the customs union. It doesn't add up. It's completely unconvincing. Britain needs to be part of Europe. Of course, Europe's policy towards Nigeria can change, but that you change that by changing the policy of Europe towards Nigeria.
Okay, and just to be clear to everyone, everyone in Compass loves everybody else, and that's why we keep losing.
No, I'm being passionate, but I mean,
I know, yeah, and so you should be. These are deeply held, difficult, and passionate issues. John, over to you to respond to Anthony where and how you want. But, you know, again, going back to how do we drive this conversation forward? Sure. You know, given the basis of what you've already outlined,
we're not going to fall out. But let me just say this: I don't tell lies, Anthony. I do not tell lies. What I've told you about the reason that were given to me why that speech was never made, I was told by people who know, people writing speeches, was that they couldn't because they'd agreed to the customs union. That is just the truth. So please don't say I'm misleading people. I'm not. It's not a very strong argument, but that's what I was told why it didn't happen. And it solved a problem for me because I simply didn't understand why Germany didn't make it. But look, the bigger question is this, England first. Yeah, I am English. I come from Middle England. I come from Yorkshire, right in the middle of England, probably quite in the near to the geographic centre. My England, I am proud of. My England. I'm proud of being Yorkshire. I'm proud of being English in the sense that I'm working class. I'm a building worker by trade. I ended up as a Labour MP by accident. The people I represent, my constituency is scarred with 100 years of struggle for social and economic progress from the strike all the way backwards and since as well. We fought, the people I represent, fought for justice, for the end of oppression, the end of exploitation. They went on strike for the nurses because the nurses couldn't, it was seen at that time, strike for themselves. They expressed solidarity with the people in South Africa during apartheid and so on. I will not accept that England is some sort of scummy place, though the government are clearly scummy. But my England doesn't include the British ruling class who have betrayed our national interest in the sense that I'm defining our nation, the nation that I belong to, the people who I represent, the person who I am, who my sister is, who my family are. And it's those people who betrayed us. So I think I nationalism worries me in the sense that it implies somehow there's something in common, like genetic maybe, or whatever it might be, our history, which binds us together. But there's more which separates us from certain parts of the English, the people who ruled our country and ruled it so badly. So the conclusion that people in my constituency came to, remember, they were out in strike for a year. The industry was destroyed in an instant. I represent 23 pit villages, for those who don't know. And they were left with no industry. You know, the only jobs that came were warehouses. There were more deaths in the warehouses than there'd been in the pits because there was no standards of health and safety and so on. People came to the conclusion that this is my language, not theirs. But I can use our language, but we bet not because it involves swear words. But the sense that they've lost agency. When you were a collier or a family of a collier, there was an element to which the villages, I live in a pit village, bore the imprint of the class which was digging the coal. And so there was a sense of agency. The clubs, the bands, the choirs, you know, the sporting facilities were all provided by the miners. You know, they were hegemonic within that community. And it went, that sense of agency, of the capacity to imprint on the community that you inhabit, you know, your values and the way you want to live your life, and values of solidarity. Let me just tell you a quick story. When I first arrived, a woman, there's a fire in a terrace house, two children get killed in the fire. A man came to me and he said, I want to give you £1,000 in cash. I said, well, I'm not taking it, but why? He said, I want you to bury the two children because they'll be in paupers' graves. He wasn't a rich man. I arranged for the money, but I wouldn't touch the money. That's solidarity. And I reckon that happens in probably every village and neighborhood in our country, that kind of thing, every day. That's the England I belong to. Now, the thing is, but the sense of loss of agency locally, regionally, and nationally. And I think on this point, Anthony is completely right. My answer is to tackle, first of all, the class structures, but the state structures. So the British state itself is an agency which has itself abandoned, the ability to help people in difficulty. They voted against the European Union. It was the first time in their lives, most of them, that they've been, said since 97 election, when they voted in massive numbers for Labour, thinking it would be different. The first time in their lives, someone said, you make a decision and we will implement it. And they thought, well, fuck this. I am gonna do my damnedest to upskittle, you know, the way things are organised. And then senior members of the Labour Party and the left said, we've done it, you know, not anybody on this call, in a kind of platonic, the ideas of Plato, the fear of the mob, the uneducated, the people who, you know, who don't understand the issues, got a majority. Just a minute. Those people who did that denied the very agency which Boris Johnson and the others had promised. Now, it's clear where we are now. I think that in the end, Brexit won't deliver the kind of promises that were made. It was a false promise. And I think people will begin to see through that. It will take time. But the left, never mind the Labour Party for a second, the left needs Compass, which is a space where intelligent conversations can take place, where we can say these are difficult issues, and we can respect each other without setting up strawman arguments. Like Anthony just said to me that I said the European Union was racist. I never used the word racism. And it's wrong to set up strawman arguments. I just described how it is. And we've got to find a space where we can talk intelligently to each other, but more importantly, listen as well.
I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass and is made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Clive. Here's Clive on why he joined the Compass community.
My name's Clive Lewis. I'm a Labour MP for Norwich South. I've been involved with Compass for 7 years or more and a member for a few years now. My involvement with Compass first started because it was the first left-wing organisation I saw that was really pushing forward the environmental agenda. This was years ahead of anything that was being talked about in Labour at the time, and I thought it was fantastic. I keep supporting Compass today because it's a refuge, you know, in a political environment which, to be quite frank, is extremely tribal, it's extremely difficult. It's the culture of Compass. It's about asking difficult questions and acknowledging that there will be differences. But actually, those differences are a strength, not a weakness. You can be in any faction of the Labour Party or any faction of the Green Party or the Liberal Democrats or any other progressive organisation or in no political party, just someone who's interested in the world around them and want to see the world change for the better. It's where I get my political sustenance from, and it means a lot to me to be a part of that community, and that's why I would wholeheartedly endorse it to you.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the conversation.
Fantastic, John. I mean, fantastic from all three of you so far. Over to you, Gabriel, now, to bring some members in and their questions and some quickfire answers before we begin to wrap up. So over to you, Gabriel.
Thanks, Neil. We've got some great questions in to follow that fascinating discussion. And to kick us off, we've got one from Barbara Totnes.
I think one fundamental problem is our outdated electoral system, first past the post. It feeds divisions, not thoughtful compromise, and these divisions keep the rich and privileged in power. The sooner we join the vast majority of EU countries and many other modern democracies and move to a system of proportional representation so that each party has the number of MPs in proportion to votes cast for that party, it's not a panacea, yet I think it's an important step. Do you think the Labour Party needs to come out very soon in favour of it? Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara. Next up, we had a question from Stuart White.
Yeah, I was interested in John Trickett's mention of the constitutional convention process that he worked on. And I was just wondering whether the panelists think there's a role for something like that going forward, perhaps focus specifically on England.
Thanks, Stuart. Great question. And should we take one more in this round? We've got one from Colin Miller.
Does the panel think that we're in the process of the outcomes of Brexit as a kind of slow car crash? Every time we get a bit of news, like last night on Newsnight, they were talking about there being a shortage of something like 100,000 lorry drivers, so we can't actually deliver anything into the country because all the foreign lorry drivers have gone back to Europe. And we've seen what's going on with Northern Ireland, other reports about people closing down restaurants because they can't get the staff for that. I get the sense that this isn't teething problems. This is kind of a rolling disaster happening. And I'm just wondering what the panel think. Will this do for the Brexit argument eventually in some way?
Thanks, Colin. Back over to you, Neil.
Three questions, yes. Yeah? So, Zoe, do you want to come back on those?
Yeah, I do. I'm going to go backwards. It's really interesting, the Brexit disaster unfolding, because as you say, it seems to kind of it seems to be really incremental. Like I hadn't really noticed anything being interrupted until suddenly I ran out of vape juice. So now you can't get vape juice anywhere in London. And it's kind of meeting loads and loads of things. People are posting pictures of the empty vegetable aisle, the empty vegetable row at the top of every aisle. And you see it in so many shops. There's just one empty row. And you think this is the beginning of something very weird. There was a YouGov poll yesterday that showed who's the percentage of people who thought Brexit was going well. Only 25% of the entire country thinks it's going well, but only 5% of Labour voters think it's going well, as opposed to 8% of Remainers. So as I said all along, by the way, the Labour voters are even more Remainy than Remainers are, and they aren't going to, they're never going to come round to it. There's nothing in it for anybody to say, oh, well, maybe this was a good idea, even if anything good happened. But I don't think anybody was quite braced for how much upheaval is coming. You know, you can't lose 45% of your European export market and not notice. You can't lose your ability to kind of trade freely generally outside of food and drink and not notice. You know, farming isn't going to not notice. Fishing isn't going to not notice. Consumers aren't going to not notice. And there will be a kind of, you know, steady acknowledgement that it was a kind of disaster. And it's like what Ken Clark used to say about Iraq. Now, if you walk down the street, you cannot find one person who ever supported it. But at the time, to oppose it was quite a trenchant political position. And I think exactly the same thing will happen in Brexit. In 5 years' time, you won't be able to find anybody who ever thought it was a good idea. Nobody has to keep their ballot and say, look, it's here it is, I can prove I was a Remainer. What really worries me is that I think, unlike any previous government I've known, there seems to be a kind of glee in disaster in this government, where there's no point at which they say this is so bad that we actually have to think seriously about it. Nothing is so bad that they can't leverage it for a secondary political point. So every time anything goes wrong, they see it as grist to the mill of continuing to blame the EU. And you can see their point strategically, because the minute they stop being able to blame the EU, they're going to have some really difficult questions to answer. So I think rather than sit and wait for everybody to kind of catch up with where you were already, you have to think, how do you get round the fact that they're quite happy to see these industries completely cut off at the knee if it means that they can make a cheap point on question time? And that is really what's ahead of us now. It's not really whether or not I run out of vape juice, even though that is obviously a massive problem.
Anthony, which one do you want to come back on?
Well, I'll go back very quickly on all three. I'm in favour of PR, absolutely. But it does mean that the Labour Party, it ends Labourism for the Labour Party. This is the crucial point. It means that Labour is saying we've got to govern with other people. And it ends that idea that they will become, you know, the successors of Attlee. And I think it was a great tragedy that the Corbyn lot never embraced PR as a clear defining policy. Stuart White's question about a constitutional convention for England, I'm entirely in favour of this. And I think it's particularly important, and I'm very much looking forward to John's answer on this, because I think it's almost impossible to have such a convention with Scotland and Wales if you're going to say to them, well, you're quite free to leave. It's like saying they're going to have a constitutional convention, but we're going to set terms and conditions. Whereas if you want to have a real citizens' convention, which is brought in by sortition and so on, it's got to be within what is an accepted national community. So I'm very much in favour of that. And I think the point of the two other things I want to say, the point of Colin's question about a car crash, I've always thought that at some level or other, Brexit economically would probably work, because we're a big cap of this country. It's a big capitalist world. They will want to keep things going. There's lots of money to be made on all sides and so on. The American banks, they will follow the money, so they'll withdraw from the city. The edge, the fact that we had it both ways will go. But I've never thought, it may be that Zoe's right and it will be an economic disaster. But politically, the image I use is of a supernova. A supernova is when a star dies, it emits a great pulse of energy and then collapses into a black hole. And I think that Brexit was a great pulse of democratic energy. The whole world was amazed and it spoke, England spoke, and now we are collapsing into a black hole with the dark gravity. And I think particularly the first edge of this is Ireland, and they will start to arm the Ulster Volunteers. They'd rather have a war in Ireland than accept that Brexit can't work. So I do think that politically as a project, it is doomed. And the quicker we need to confront that, we've got to confront the Brexit narrative. And the last thing I just want to say, because I want to apologize to John, I hope I didn't say that you said the EU was racist, but the implication, which I hope is what I did say, of saying it's white, it's Christian, they don't have anybody of mixed race or hardly anybody in the parliament. Look at what they're doing to Nigeria. The implication of that is that somehow we're a better people and they are dealing with it in that it felt racist the way it was being talked about. And of course, like the British state, it's a very ambivalent project, but we have to be part of that. And I feel very much this point that you made about it's indeed what I wrote in my book on, you know, the lure of greatness. One Brexiteer said to me, you have described better the reasons for Brexit than anybody else I've ever read, which is the passion that people felt finally they could say to the people that had ruled them, up yours. And of course they did. And I think your description is very telling. But the point is, it wasn't Europe that was responsible for what had happened to them. And our job, so to speak, it seems to me your job as a political leader and mine as a political commentator is to say, we accept your rage, but we don't accept that the EU is the cause. And in Scotland, they're the same communities. If you take Paisley, which produces 90% of the world's cotton thread in the end of the last century, at the end of the 19th century, you know, the same mining communities had a party in the SNP they felt represented them, and they didn't vote for Brexit. And what they missed in the Labour Party was a party that would speak for them and would have that sense of being what it about. So I think that the reference to the miners' strike there is really, really important. There was a deep betrayal by the whole elite, including New Labour, of what happened to the mining communities, and they took their revenge. They took their revenge on the wrong people.
Brilliant. Well, John, over to you.
Yeah, let me just come in. I think, first thing is, it's true, that's what happened in mining communities. And I think, by the way, it's also, I'm not here to defend Labour leaderships. I'm here to say what I think. I mean, I've spent 12 blooming years. I was I sat in the cabinet room with the Labour cabinet for 2 years. But then I was working with Ed and then with Jeremy. I've done 12 blooming years. So look, I've seen a lot of mistakes being made and I try to counsel against them as, you know, you hope to get your voice heard. So I'm not here to defend Labour leadership. Electoral politics drives you into taking positions which are sometimes fudged and mudged and triangulating and all the other things which we know and repent at. In my view, that is not how the Labour Party leadership should run. We should tell it as it is and hold the line. And that's what I've always tried to do personally. So I'm not here to defend and we're not discussing the future of the Labour Party, as far as I know. We're discussing what do we do next about Brexit. But I just want to just say, yeah, I think that the Brexit deal, which has been done by the Tories, and let's be clear, it was a racist and xenophobic, backward-looking kind of project. And I fully understand why people on the left hated that and wanted not to be anywhere near it. I fully understand that. I get that. But I think that the Brexit we've got is like a slow crash, and it will eventually fail. I think that is true. Was that necessarily the only form of Brexit? Maybe not. But that's not where we are. We are where we are. There's no point in wishing for things that haven't happened. But I want to just mention the Constitutional Convention and PR. Because it seems to me, and you and I talked about it, Anthony, but so did Neil and I quite a lot. It seemed to me, if we've lost as a country, or as a class anyway, as the class, as loft faith in where politics operates, then they will not vote for a party of hope. They will vote for fear. They live in fear. The future looks like a dangerous place. People want to go back to the past because change which has happened to so many communities was damaging. The idea of change is quite a frightening thing in many ways. So you think, you know, it tends to lead to a reactionary kind of position for people. However, here's the thing. If we're going to restore hope, we have to show that politics is capable of delivering. And nobody has faith in the way the political structures work at the moment out there, except, you know, a bunch of MPs probably. And therefore, we've got to work out how to change our politics. Now, the way we change our politics is as important as what we change. And the only way, it seems to me, to regain consent is to hand over the key decisions to a wide-ranging, citizen-led constitutional assembly. Now, why do I say that? Because in Scotland, it wasn't citizen-led, if you remember. It was led by the so-called Great and Good. I don't think that's going to work for England. It's got to be wider than that. Now, I'm going to spend just a couple of seconds explaining what I did, because it's important. Anthony knows this, by the way. It's important that people understand. On behalf of Jeremy, I approached every single party leader in the House of Commons and asked them to sign up to a shared approach to a constitutional convention. And I still got the letter that was signed. I approached them all. There was a widespread understanding that we had to change things. And we then went to a large funding organization, because running a constitutional convention as an opposition is a very difficult thing. It's never been really done. Usually it's governments that do them, and they've got access to large amounts of money. We needed a very, very large, a seven-figure sum to get a constitutional convention running. It was important that it wasn't run by any politician, but that it was set up by all the political parties. And it was agreed. And we even had a funder. But the meeting to give us the money, not to give me the money, by the way, to give to a group of universities that were going to run this, was scheduled to take place on, I think it was 24th of June, when, as you know, the referendum result came out. And then the funder said, well, look, the constitution is now completely shattered because of the Brexit vote. We've decided not to make the money available. The whole thing fell apart. But I still dream it. And as a final point then, on PR, Anthony, you've got a brilliant mind, and I love you, but your memory is slightly defective, if I might say this, in one matter only. I'm sure that the rest of you is impeccable, but when we discuss PR in the relation of the Constitutional Convention, my response to you wasn't bugger off, I'm not interested in PR. My response to you is, we're about to set up a citizens' convention, and then we're going to say in advance we've already decided that we're going to have PR. Hang on a minute, isn't that a decision that should go to the people, if that's what we believe in? And by the way, the people might well have come up with PR. I don't know. But that's what happened. It's never been told before publicly, that story. Probably ought to write it up at some point.
OK, brilliant, John. Gabriel, I've got one final question to put to the panel for quick fire answers. So get, I think it's Phil in, isn't it?
Yeah, we've got one last question from Phil Edwards.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, it's a question of a practical politics, really. While we're waiting for this new vision of energy that's going to counter the right-wing view, do you think that Labour Party voters have assumed agency in Amersham and said that sod the rules, we're going to vote tactically? And is that an indicator of change to come?
So are we moving to a goal of a progressive alliance to meet the regressive alliance, which was crystallised and formalised out of that Brexit process and now seems to be hegemonic? John, let's start with you and finish with Zoe.
I think there's some truth in that. Yeah, I think there is some truth in that. I don't know how much truth we've got. I'm told we've got 600 members and 622 people voted for us, but I don't know quite who they were, what the reasons were, but clearly there was a substantial decline in the Labour vote. People probably may well have thought that it was easier to beat the Tories by voting for the party which had got historical roots, larger historical roots than Labour. The Labour Party or any other party doesn't own its voters. They're not our property to hand over to other parties in some sort of stitch-up deal in Westminster or somewhere. People are intelligent. I find people, some of them, you know, to quote one of my colleague MPs, said they're all uneducated. I think meaning we shouldn't listen to them. But the people I meet are amongst the most intelligent people, and they understand what's going on in politics. They're entitled to make a decision, and they're capable of making decisions. It looks to me as though the vast majority of people in that constituency didn't want a blooming MP from the Tory party and found out a way to stop it.
Okay. Anthony, what do you think the repercussions of that are and the implications?
I agree strongly with what John has just said, that people know what they're doing. And I think that they feel that the party system has left them behind. They don't want anything really, they don't feel loyal to it in the way they did. And all this evidence that people feel more remainers or more leavers than anything else is quite a profound thing. And it goes back to the point that John was making, that they took a decision. They were given the chance to take a decision and they took one. As if we, all of us, took an executive call. We, for the once in our lives, we were allowed to say what we thought and with consequence. And that's why we've kind of stuck to it, because that was a very important moment, right or wrong. And one of the very striking things about the shift of opinion since Brexit over 5 years is that there hasn't been a shift of opinion, because people took a decision, they made a call, they want to see it happen or not happen, and that is a very important part of it. And that means that they've moved into a different space from feeling that the parties represent them. So I think that Labour's vote went down to 1/10. I think Neil said to me that it was one vote less than the total membership. So the Labour Party in that part of the world, it's basically disappeared. And I think that that could happen anywhere across England. But the same is also true about the Conservative Party. One of the very striking things about what's going on is that although Johnson is kind of has grasped this, thinks that there's got to be a narrative, a story in the journalistic, and he's a very capable journalist, his journalistic way, Great Britain, nobody believes a word he says. And we all know that he's a charlatan. And that's like, okay, well, they've gone off, but you know, we haven't gone off. We're still here. And who believes in the Liberal Democrats? So I think that there's the tragedy from my own point of view is that the Greens also just haven't stepped up to the mark. So I think people are voting this point, if you will, that John said, that people have removed consent. I think that process is continuing, that's why you want a constitutional convention to reestablish it, and that the linkage that was a deep linkage built up over a century and a half between the public and our representatives is now being broken wholesale.
Okay, thanks, Anthony. And finally, and reasonably quickly, over to you, Zoe. Thank you.
Sorry, the reason I'm smiling is I can't believe we're having this conversation in a Compass meeting like we've never had it before. We're like one of those old married couples who turns up and tells the anecdote about the time they went to Crete. I mean, we've literally had this conversation 1,000 times in 1,000 Compass meetings. And we've seen, right? You know, you saw a huge amount of tactical voting by Lib Dems in 1997, which is what delivered the landslide. You saw a huge amount of tactical voting in 2017, which is why none of the polls came true. You saw a huge amount of tactical voting wherever anybody can identify who the likely contender is. What the problem's been in elections and constituencies where no tactical voting is observable is because there isn't enough energy around any candidate for anybody to think, sod it, my guy's not going to win, but I don't want that person, therefore I'll get behind this person. And really, if you want tactical voting to work in any observable fashion, somebody has to have a lot of energy and a lot of kind of winning mojo. And I think that's the problem with Labour at the moment, is they don't have the winning mojo. Nobody's giving them their tactical vote. And so they're digging in their heels and saying, we're not pro-PR and we're not pro-electoral cooperation. The truth of it is there will have to be At the very least, some non-aggression pacts between progressive candidates in seats all over the country. That will have to happen. But I'm kind of losing hope in it ever coming from the top, because so many different Labour leaders have squashed it for such stupid reasons that it doesn't even seem to be a kind of ideological stance anymore to squash it. It just seems to be Labour DNA. We don't cooperate. And, you know, we don't even cooperate to screw the Greens, let alone cooperate for the sake of cooperation. So that's where I think Labour is. I would be very surprised if, I mean, you know, we've had the Progressive Alliance conversation a lot of times as well. I remember in the 2015 Green conference, we were talking about whether to call it the Rebel Alliance or the Coalition of the Losers. And that seems to be where we still are. You know, we all know that it's necessary. We all know that you won't get constitutional reform or voter reform without it. But none of us are prepared to do it. The final point is that the only reason anybody ever gave for PR being a bad idea was that it let in the far right. Now, we've had an object lesson smashed in our face like a custard pie of how the far right triumphs perfectly easily in a first-past-the-post system. And I think we should acknowledge that and move on to a new level of the conversation we've had so many times.
Fantastic. And I think the difference between then and now, Zoe, is that Rebel Alliance is happening. Certainly we know it in Compass and see it. We see it across the country in councils, in counties, in our local groups, etc. We saw it in Chesham and Amersham. This will be a Rebel Alliance from the bottom and the grassroots up, because the voters and the activists are a long way ahead from the politicians other than John Trickett. So I think that's the form it's going to take. And that's what we have to harness and help and give political leadership to. So that was a brilliant, amazing conversation. I can't wait to listen back to it, because it was full of love and, like any family, some ruptures and some differences. But I think, you know, for me, you unpacked so much of that. So thanks so much, Anthony, John and Zoe. That was really tremendous. Thanks again, all three of you.
Thanks
to all
everyone.
Our members on the
thank you. Lovely to see you,
as ever. Thank you. Keep safe and keep hopeful. Thanks, everyone. Take
you
care.
Too.
Good night.
Bye.
So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast, and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil_Compass or Compass at Compass Office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.